This season of Perf Bites is brought to you by Hewlett-Packard Enterprise. HPE has the expertise and solutions you need to transform your business or government and change the world. Learn more at hpe.com. Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, accelerating next. And Flood.io. We sort out the infrastructure so you can spend more time testing. Flood.io is load testing simplified. Learn more at www.flood.io.
It's time for Perf Bites.
What the f*** is Perf Bites?
The fourth square meal of the day. Don't bogart the Perf Bites. F*** waffles. Microwave ready. Add nutritional value to your brain.
Right up, jackalope.
It's time for Perf Bites with your hosts Mark Tomlinson, James Pulley, and Howard Chorney.
Perf Bites.
Whatever.
Hey, Perf Biters, Mark here. You know, we had such a great time on the new tools episode that we talked on and on and on and on. And the truth is, the original title was New Tools and New Techniques. And of course, the new techniques were so interesting, at least we found them interesting, that we decided we would just talk on and on and on for like another hour. So I split them into two episodes. This is really part two of New Tools and New Techniques. And so hopefully we didn't get too tired. But I hope you enjoy this second half, part two, part deux of New Tools and thus New Techniques. Enjoy. All right, welcome back, everybody. We are going to talk a little bit about some of the changes in techniques. Techniques. What the heck do we mean by techniques, Howard?
By techniques, well, that's sort of the methods that we do things in.
Yeah. So if you've been sort of doing the old way, so to speak, and when I say doing it, I do mean just load testing.
Huh.
I'm just going to stop myself right here from where the metaphor is going in my brain.
So this show will be rated PG-13.
Yeah, so this would be sort of new practices that you may not be doing already that we're starting to see a lot of people sort of lean this direction or start adopting this direction. At the same time, it could be something you do with the existing tool set. Maybe it's an old tool set, and I don't want to say old, but the legacy tool set, like a LoadRunner tool set or even an older Borland or an older type of installation for load testing. The Visual Studio tools, you know, maybe you've got an old version of that.
How about MS Test? Do you have an old version of MS Test?
Yeah, QA Load. That was good. But here's the idea of these new techniques. And James, you want to kick us off with one that actually is a little bit similar to LightSquare.
This is just kind of a quick and dirty. You want to understand if your environment is configured correctly, if you're throwing an enormous number of errors for whatever reason. Just take a snapshot of the size of your logs for all of your services at the beginning of the test, and then look at their sizes at the end. You will find some outliers during the test, and these are usually due to misconfiguration of the logging model. That is, they've set it to debug or info instead of error. As you might do in production.
Yep, info level, yeah.
Or you've actually got genuine errors being kicked off on a particular tier. And you'll want to look at that because error code is very rarely optimized versus happy path code.
Yeah. Now, this is something that back in the day I used to actually write as a LoadRunner script. And the LoadRunner script would actually use, say, the FTP protocol and would schedule it in the scheduler before, as a dependency. The first script to run would capture the size of a remote shell or just an FTP. You can just get a listing of the files on a remote server and look at the size of the log file before the test, like a pre-test phase.
Yep.
And then you run your scenario, and the very last script that you would schedule in the scheduler would be something that looks at the same servers, repeat that, and then compare the pretest size to the post-test size.
And if you're really creative, you can use something like RTE script to log into all of these hosts, collect information on their sizes, store it in a memory variable, and then set the iteration to complete at the end of the test where you collect the same information from the same host and you do a diff on it.
Yep.
And report them as data points.
Yeah, exactly. Put them as data points right in the results. The other thing I see happening is when, like in the DIY stack that has Rundeck, you could do pretest jobs and post-test jobs. One of the customers I work with, you'd put in the pretest, you'd actually grep the logs before you run the test. In a pretest,
grep for the word debug, capital debug, which is log4j, a lot of the Java shops, even .NET shops, standard debug info, trace yep. level, error level. So look for debug, and there should be a count of zero. There should be no debug messages in the log before you start your test. And that means, hey, the logging level is probably set. We're going to guess probably set okay. And then after the test, you do another grep or a cat through grep to say, all right, did while we were running the test, were there any debug or error messages? And give me a count of those, pull them back, put them in a trend.
Here's one that I'm seeing more and more often, Mark, is developers setting their message class to the wrong class for logging.
Oh, yeah.
So even if you're set for info or trace, if your log level class is set incorrectly, you're still going to output it to the log.
I tell you, this is a pet peeve of mine, that there are developers who, for some reason, don't have control in their own developer environment, and they'll just put everything in info mode. And so there's things that should be reserved for debug mode.
Yep.
Getting logged into info mode just because a developer is like, mm-hmm. well, that's the easiest thing to do. I know debug mode is not enabled in my QA. And, you know, that's the zombie developer who doesn't really use their brain. Suddenly your info mode logging is just bloated. And you're like, half of this stuff easily can be in debug mode because you don't need it every day. And your support people and your ops guys are the ones who should make the call on, hey, these are message levels I need every day.
Well, they still have to parse through all the data, too, to determine what's viable and what isn't, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but the last thing you want is really exploding logs like that, particularly during a high load situation.
I know, because it'll take you forever to parse through the damn data.
No, because you can run out of log space.
Oh, that too.
I'll tell you even more. A lot of people think that log4j is completely async, right? Any of these logging infrastructures, .NET or Java, they think they're completely async. And for the most part, they are completely async until the log IO backs up so badly that it can't open another thread, and then it backs up where? Right into the app. So suddenly you're looking, say, in a tool like Dynatrace or New Relic, and you're, where's all this logging overhead coming from? Well, you know what? You either blew out your log space, or the IO is so bloated that you actually backed up the queue of log messages back into the app. So the automated log checking before and after, that's the simple thing to do, and then get more elaborate and start actually parsing out different messages. That's a really, really cool technique I'm seeing people get up. And I think it's part of it is the the perf hounds.
Hounds are barking.
Yeah, they don't like large logs either.
No logging. No,
they don't.
Yeah.
What next on the list of new techniques do we have out there?
Exactly. The other thing I'm seeing, and I'm giving a workshop on this actually very soon, is the idea of this whole, the visual of a waterfall diagram. Do you guys have any clue how popular that diagram, that visual? You can get it out of Chrome. You can get it out of browser, your Firefox.
Are we talking the waterfall diagram where you can look at all the calls?
Yeah.
Happening. Yeah, it's a great tool. I use them all the time.
Yeah, marketing people, for some reason, love this waterfall graph.
It's oddly, this waterfall graph is something that even non-technical people can somehow understand the sequence and flow of time. And so, thank you, Steve Souders. It's become so pervasively popular in so many tools that non-techies are starting to sort of gravitate to it.
Hey, it's a really great way to troubleshoot front-end problems just by looking at the waterfall diagram. You can see everything going on. I mean, I found some really cool stuff. Well, because the tool I use has a dynamic waterfall dashboard that I could look at problems in real time. And I've been able to do some really great troubleshooting on the front end as we've been running the test.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. I think the main thing that I'm witnessing is that if your QA team, and they spend all day long, every day, messing around with the front end of your application, figuring out different test cases, doing exploratory testing, and they are doing all of this work functionally with the front end of the application. And if your automated functional team, your functional testing team, manual or automated, I guess, if they don't understand a waterfall diagram and they don't understand how to capture one at different significant steps within the business transaction, within the steps of the test procedure, they're missing out. And so this is a technique I think that is rather new. It's rather invading functional test automation.
Now, Mark, something that's pushing this is this concept of rendering. We've got to find out rendering. I'm actually giving a chat at STPCon coming up in the spring about how this obsession with rendering is actually killing your performance testing.
You're going to render your opinion on that one, James?
Yeah,
I'm going to render something about it. You're absolutely right.
Exactly. But this is the idea that as a new technique, infusing these waterfall diagrams and or client-side performance techniques into functional automation is a really, really important thing that you need to consider doing. Because that information, you don't need to wait for a load test in order to tell your developer, oh, by the way, this is totally screwed up. Your caching is screwed up. Your size of your image.
Buy that man an Ardbeg for everything he's saying right now.
Yeah, exactly.
You're delivering your page in the wrong order. You're causing blocking calls right off the bat. We shouldn't have to wait till it gets into the performance test team to be able to figure that out.
You have 15 monitoring solutions all on the same page because 15 different people in marketing each like their own individual tool.
And as we know, to be obnoxious about it, if it doesn't scale for one, it will never scale for many.
For many.
serious. And it's also actionable things that are so easy to fix. Now, if Steve Souders hadn't actually gone off the charts and created a whole set of books about how to fix these kinds of things, you'd log a bug as a functional tester and your developers would be like, I don't know what you're talking about. But actually now, since a lot of these rules engines and things that are in the browser, if you're not publishing a waterfall diagram or actually using a tool like GTmetrix or YSLO or these things to figure out how to grade this stuff and send it to your developer, now if you log a bug on these client-side performance things, send it to development, chances are they can do one query into Stack Overflow, boom, they know how to fix it. And that's the real win, right? The win is not just logging bugs, it's getting them all the way to closure. And that's what really makes things...
And this really tool really helps on that diagnostic part of the diagnostic analysis piece. It really helps on that, and it lets you as a QA engineer be a little more prescriptive on what the issue is too. And the developers usually appreciate that.
Now, Mark, you brought this next one to the attention of Howard and myself. This thing called Redbot?
Yeah. So because it's API driven, this little tool called Redbot, now of all the different violations you can have within client-side performance, speaking of Steve Souders and YSLO and these things, is that you have screwed up the expires cache header. Now, here's the goofy thing about Redbot makes it easy just as a tool because it's API driven and you can actually assess these things as a client side tool and know within a few seconds, you know, in a repeated way, hey, yes, these expires headers are right. There's no violations. It's a lot like YSLO in a grading way. Here's the problem I see with Redbot. Even though expires headers is probably the number one violation that we've seen, you know, you remember on the News of the Dam, we see, you know, set the expire header correctly, or sometimes it's set a far future expires header is the big rule that they have. And we see this on News of the Damned all the time. It'd be nice to catch that in functional testing as well. So the technique I'm seeing is that you use a tool like Redbot rather than the whole YSLO or the whole other stuff just to catch these particular kinds of violations. So as a technique, it's really good. At the same time, if your ops guys are not configuring headers, there may be a reason that your headers for expires headers in QA might not be set right. So using Redbot in prod is really, really great as sort of a continuous testing. You can script this thing, you can make these calls, and it'll monitor it for you, sort of. Monitor my headers to make sure we don't do something stupid. Moving that forward into load test or into functional testing, well, in load test, you should have the exact same configuration for expires headers as you do in the real world, hopefully. Sometimes in QA, well, those environments are more like dev. They're not really like prod, so maybe they're not configured right. But Redbot is another new tool to check out just because it specifically goes after what I think, at least I observe, the number one problem with very casual, hey, let's just, you know, publish this website, release this web page, release this app component, blah, blah, blah. and they forget all about caching, even the most casual built-in caching that's already there.
So would you say this is more on the novice side versus the...
No, I don't think it's more on the novice side at all, because even when you get very mature performance testing teams, a lot of them will turn off download static components because they don't have an integration with the CDN vendor. And so they're making the assumption that all the caching is set correctly. And I find that whenever they make that assumption, 100% of the time they are incorrect.
Yeah.
And, you know, it doesn't take too much for a font that's located on every single page, a JavaScript or something of that nature, before that becomes 90% of the load on your website.
So if you found these with like enterprise size clients?
Yes. Yeah. Howard, including some that you and I share.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no absolutely. Kidding.
I know who that is.
Now, to James's point, I mean, the real issue is that you have a load testing team turning off static content, making an assumption, and then they don't ever follow through. There's no connection to say, we assume the following components are going to be X, Y, and Z. And there's no way for the ops guys to come back and go, well, wait a minute, you gave us this list of static content that you assume is cached in the CDN. We don't even know what the caching topology looks like for these resources, and we have no tool to fill the gap. We're not connected. So looking at a tool like Redbot, they can connect.
Yeah, and nobody's talking to, say, the Apache administrator who sets all the, you know, caching by MIME type because, you know, that guy's out back drinking a beer somewhere.
Nothing wrong with drinking a beer, especially if you're a web administrator. I mean, really. I mean, I mean, if you're a DBA or a network guy, you're drinking single malt. And I'm having a nice Ardbeg Korjevecken. It's really, really flavorful Korjevecken. You won't find it everywhere. It's very swell.
What's next on the docket?
Next on the list, Howard, I'm going to hand this to you, my friend, because there's just a huge category. Still, the new tools and techniques, continuousness, continuous integration, continuous delivery,
continuous integration.
Testing. I got three customers right now just hammering at me for continuousness, and I'm like, the simplest way is just repeat the test every 15 minutes.
Well, that's not really reasonable.
Of course it's not reasonable, but it blows up in their face of 9 times out of 10, and it makes them wake up and go, why does that thing keep failing? And then they find that's, here you go.
Because you turned on continuous.
Because it's repeating every 15 minutes. It runs 100 threads as fast as it can.
Well, really, let's talk about what continuousness or continuous integration should be. And I would say running every 15 minutes, probably not it.
No, that's right. That's no. A little crazy.
But it would be a little insane. But, you know, most teams out there going in this direction are basically running their test suite off their build.
Right.
And, right, most tools today can be driven by Jenkins or TeamCity, Bamboo, whatever. And then you can just write into the API and you can just kick the test off right from the build, which, again, if we talk about earlier when I was talking about auto-provisioning of grids, it sort of makes that particular feature even more valuable, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So you can bring up a grid while you kick it off. And I know earlier we were kind of debating before the show on, you know, usefulness and getting value from the results. And I know we were discussing how, you know, some clients do, some don't. And, you know, why is that? What can we do to help drive folks in the right direction?
Yeah.
And, you know, I just have one thing to say about that. Just like any other software solution, you get out of it what you put in. If you don't design it right and validate things, you're doing what needs to be done, I guess you'll get the results that your solution so richly deserves, right? Yeah, so it's like anything. You got to put the discipline in.
Howard, come on. That's not a crap test. That's fertilizer.
But, Howard, to your point, I think, actually, I'll ask James, the idea that, you know, there are people that write bad tests, and even if you automate continuously a bad test, it's not going to help you any more than if you ran it manually, right? In fact, if you do it more frequently, a bad test, bad design for a test, it doesn't validate something.
A false positive or a false negative does not help you appropriately measure risk before you make a decision to go live.
I think it could be more dangerous just because if you do it more continuously, it may become indoctrinated in the culture.
Yes.
And you'll start trusting this false result because it's automated and it came from my favorite continuous tool. So I think to Howard's point, you get out of it what you put into it. And that's absolutely right, my friend. If you build a great test, why not run that test more often? Why not run that test as frequently as you can run it, you know, and still have people take action? They potentially find a bug. And if they do find a bug, they get it as soon as possible.
Do. If you run a really nice API test suite, you could just really go, you know, off of every build, you can kick the crap out of every service that you have, right?
And so
Mark, as we talk about this question of value, I'm reminded of the television show Friends and Chandler Bing and the Weenus Report.
We brought that up on the year in review.
The Weenus Report.
Lightsquare.com is proud to be a sponsor of Perf Bytes. Lightsquare.com is a unique offering for performance tuning as a service for web architectures. Lightsquare delivers tuning recommendations in under 72 hours without the typical investment in tools, license fees, or consultants, where we do the work up front. With Lightsquare, you only pay based on the level of improvement. Find out more about Lightsquare's unique pricing model at www.litesquare.com/pricing.
The Weenus Report, yes. So you have this report. It's critical that it be run, and it's got to be run on time. What does it mean?
I have no idea.
Once again, I guess you get what you put into it.
I have no idea. So if you're doing a load testing practice pre-production and you're trying to figure out do I work closer to production or do I work closer to development, the more you work towards development, you're going to be asked to do more continuous stuff. So one of these great techniques, even though it's challenging, can be very beneficial to your organization to start connecting to the CI.
And many people are going that way. It absolutely has a lot of traction right now.
Yeah. And I think the best place to begin, actually, Mark, is at the unit test.
Sure.
You run, you add your component. It's built. It's automatically tested at an atomic level. You go to component assembly. The same thing happens. Once you start getting to functional and business level performance testing, you might actually have a break there, where you do something different.
James, I agree. It's not designed for that. Again, like I said earlier, I mean, the best thing is build a services suite and go kick the crap out of it at the API level, and then you'll know that you'll be confident all the time that your services are going to stand up.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, I think so. I think part of the other idea is that if you have somebody who understands as a developer how to run a unit test, and they're like, I just hit each unit once. And you just say, can you just hit it 10 times? And could you run that same thing?
That will take me 10 times.
10 threads?
More time to do
it. Well, I mean, it's like we're going to automate it. So, you know, we're just going to fire it up and you're going to be fine. And I think that resistance, to be honest, I have an outdated perception of what modern day developers want to do. If you go to a developer and say, we're going to automate this and run 10 threads, they'd be like, yeah, great, awesome. I think in their old school world, you would hit resistance on that. I don't think we see a resistance to automate anymore.
You know, something I think there may be another good thing that you've just said is that maybe the younger generations are smashing some of the old development stigmatism, or the ones at least we had from a QA perspective in the developer stigmatism, because I found a lot more cooperation when I go talk to the development teams now than in the old days.
Yeah. Part of it is that people like you and I, and James and others that follow us, we know how to articulate, hey, wouldn't it be cool if, here's the value. Wouldn't it be great if we knew X or Y? And be like, yeah, we'd love to know X and Y. That'd be awesome.
Yeah.
And bing, 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 there you go. All right. The next really awesome new technique, which I'll share, is I keep getting pinged, and I got pinged today. Pertzi was on the Slack, the PerfBytes Slack. Actually, she was on one of the other Slack channels. And one of the questions he brought to me was, well, how do we test at scale? You know, how do we test at scale, these different environments and different things? Which opens me to this next technique, reminds me of this next technique, which is the idea of prod scale testing with data. And I'm seeing a couple new tools. Now, one of the tools I've seen in the past is Grid Tools. This is a test data management solution. So you look at HP had a test data management solution many years ago. But Grid Tools just got purchased by CA. Used to be a startup. I think they were based in Denver. A bunch of cool guys. We had some long Skype chats with them. And then the other one is Delphix. Delphix has been around quite a while in the DBA world. Backups and data replication and things like that. Not quite like GoldenGate, but...
Mark, let's not forget an old standby from CA, now Dynatrace, which is FileAid, which can take your schema and build ACID-compliant test data to any size you need.
Yeah, sort of a seed. You start with a seed database and then it can replicate and multiply that.
So what do we do? So what do we do with this? This is interesting.
Well, it's a couple things I'm seeing companies do where they... Let's say they really... sold all the hardware, went into the cloud, and now all the dev test LT, even the LT environment, is like 10% scale.
Mm-hmm.
And
which,
so they
which
tried
is
that.
Reality, which is reality in these lower level environments.
It's reality, but at the same time, you know, one of the things that finally boils up, no matter how many times we said it over the last 10 years, you know, guys, extrapolation is evil. So if you're testing at 10% and you're not a PhD level, and let's say your CEO needs to be a PhD level to understand you, we can extrapolate 0.0001 budget CPU to 1,000 machines in the node running at 50% CPU, blah, 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 bitty, blah model. No business person on the planet, unless it's presented in dollar signs, will understand your model. So extrapolation is evil, not because it's inherently mathematically evil, but because for human beings, we have a hard time actually believing your math. And so I see a lot of folks returning to the idea that, well, we'd kind of like to have a full-scale load test environment. Maybe, Howard, to some extent, they went and did load testing in prod, and they really got their eyes woken up. Wow, we really need to test at scale. We're not finding any of these bugs in development.
Until we get into testing in a prod level environment.
And they might walk back from that and say, you know what, 10, 15 years ago, we used to have a full-scale LT environment, and then so-and-so cut the corners of the budget of the thing, and they don't work here anymore, but we're screwed. So they restore this idea of testing at prod scale in a load test environment. Load test environment could be in scale. It could be in prod, actually. It could be in the cloud. It could be whatever.
Or it could be at the node level or the slice level if all of these nodes or slices are identical and they're load balanced.
Yes. If you get the architecture configuration at a linear scale or uniform scale properly, yeah. I think the real technique I see here is that people are starting to figure out the test data management component of testing at scale. And the technique being that you would replicate data from prod, maybe not all the data for security purposes, you might leave some data behind, but you would move a lot of that data into LT record by record with a replication tool. And you could use Grid Tools or Delphix, GoldenGate to do that.
And by the way, I recommend if you do this, take all email addresses and phone numbers and grok them. That is, drop them, put them to a domain you own that they're going to go to a default inbox, because this is a primary source of data theft where you don't have the proper controls and tests that you do in prod, and these email addresses are being taken and they're being sold out.
That's why you should just generate bogus data.
Well, here's the trick, Howard, is that if you generate with bogus data, now if you have a legacy of going to testing at scale, you're already at a deficit of trust for your test results, because you're like, we don't really trust that you even know what you're doing. We don't trust that we give you a test environment that's at the right scale to believe your math, blah, blah, blah. So if you, one of the things you can to restore the accuracy and credibility and trust of your test results is that you start using real scale prod data. And it's actually really, really hard to generate fake data.
No doubt.
I mean, one of the easiest things I see customers doing as a technique is I'm going to replicate all of the non-restricted data. So social security numbers, email addresses, stuff are all left in prod. But roll everything else, you know, replicate everything else into LT full scale. And then do two things. One, create some fake data, fill in fake social security numbers, fill in fake email addresses, fake birth date, fake, you know, any of that actual restricted data. You might even scram.
By the way, subscribing to the Social Security Death Index will give you 70 plus million records of dead Social Security numbers, birth dates, death dates, zip codes.
Yep.
That you can use, which don't resolve to
anything. Yeah, as a source, just feed them into the little automation you have and populate all of those empty fields in the database.
What's that, www.morbiddatabase.gov?
No, it is. It's Social Security SSDI. It's probably SSDI.gov or something. It's a subscription you have to sign up for as a DVD, I think.
But to be honest with you, I mean, these things are fairly knowable, especially if they're going to be hashed or encrypted. What you might do is just, you know, roll whatever fake Social Security number you want, encrypt them, and then you've got your hashed values right there. I do this with JMeter at one of my customers. It works very, very quickly. I can run, you know, 600-800 transactions per second and fill the whole database within a matter of a couple of hours. So the idea being that I'm seeing this technique where you're populating, building a load test database as a replica of product. You might do this quarterly. You might do this monthly if you're really lucky. Maybe once a year, you know, if it's a new thing to you. But the idea of refreshing that database with real data, it's aged. Some of the batch jobs have been run on it. The volumes are up to speed. And then you replace this restricted data. And these tools like Grid Tools or Delphix have some additional features that help you do this. And that's one of the techniques I'm seeing to bring people back to full-scale databases, full-scale test environments, and they're trusting it. And some of them are building it in the cloud. Some of them are building it ad hoc. So it's really interesting. I mean, if you have let's say you have a 100 terabyte database, if you're going to make a copy of it, I think to your point, Howard, I mean, it could take 3 weeks to make a copy of 100 terabytes, depending on the IO. It could take you 3 weeks to make a copy of a production database at 100 terabytes. This is just an impossible question. So you're going to be testing at scale, but you're not puny, right? Maybe if you've got this ginormous petabyte database, maybe it takes you once a year, you take a copy of prod, scrub it, scramble it, and away you go. All right, so check out Grid Tools, check out Delphix. They got some really cool stuff going on. The last area we want to talk about, Howard, you actually talked a little bit about automatic data correlation, which is this idea, again, sort of SOSTA, harvesting information from, say, Impulse or from the real world and generating workload models for use in testing. And is that
and you're gonna see this coming out of Splunk going back into JMeter. You're gonna see it coming out of Elasticsearch into JMeter or Splunk into, you know, HP's got their own log management tool for the life of me. I can't remember the name of it. It's mostly a security appliance, but you could round that data back into LoadRunner and StormRunner as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So Howard, this is similar to what we should be seeing from a SOSTA perspective, but I mean, is it a real challenge from a technique perspective? People just don't know how to make a production simulation that's even trustworthy?
Well, you know, Mark, I was just kind of thinking about this, and I think, you know, I'm going to go old man throughout my career and through the industry. I think the workload modeling piece on the performance side is sort of newer. And that's because we have these great tools that can then show us what a real model should be like. And I think that's been, you know, especially in the e-commerce space where you have a lot of people coming in, being able to do different, you know, the general public coming in, doing all these different things. It's really important to understand how people are using your site. And so I think that's where this whole concept of workload modeling came in to begin with. So in the earlier days, we take some of the tools that we had and we, we comb through it and we got the data as best we could. And it still wasn't showing us at what every page was getting hit, where it was getting hit from, things like that. We'd have to go talk to some marketing folks and get their best guess at it, whatever tool they're using that kind of helped them out and so on and so forth. So, you know, we were building intelligent models with the data that we had, but, you know, it's not good enough. And so I think, you know, being able to take this data out of the tool and then put it through something like the data science workbench and really understand how the site's being used, that just, you know, makes the workload model such, you know, much more effective.
I have to say, James, if I think back to when we were teaching classes in the Mercury world, and we would teach, you know, how to build a workload model, right? We would build, here's this script, this many transactions per second, how many number of users would create that, and do a little simple math in a 2x2 or 3x3 table. The idea of a proactively, sort of fictitiously designed workload model was fine for waterfall, because a lot of those methodologies meant there is no production stats. There's nothing in production that even looks like this. So we are going to interrogate the business.
And you actually had very robust requirements on the waterfall side that you could draw from. Now, they were probably in a notebook that had an inch thick of dust on somebody's top shelf, but they were in fact there. Or if you were replacing a production system or updating it, you could actually go and look at how many records were added to a particular table tied to a particular business process, updates or inserts. So you had an objective piece that you could go to. What's really nice in the webby universe is you have all this freeform data in the form of logs that you can constantly query in different ways to get more and more fine levels of detail on what's going on. Or in the case of, say, an impulse, where you've got user agents that's collecting this data, you've got that same fine degree of data collection that can help.
And going back to that history lesson, James, and you and Mark were teaching for HP and LoadRunner.
Howard. It was Mercury. Mercury Interactive.
So that made it even longer ago, which is really gonna help make my point.
No, that's good.
The complexities that we were working on back then, it pales in comparison to the complexity of the sites and things that we're performance testing today. Back at that time, it was still very, you know, there was web, but there was still a ton of client server going on. And, you know, you kind of knew how many users were going to be hitting it. And you kind of, they had a limited set of things they could do. But now when you're getting into an e-commerce site, we have all these different moving parts going on. The complexity on how to test this thing from a workload modeling perspective is just tenfold of what we used to have to do.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's why these techniques are so important, and it's just so important you go out and find tools that will help you get this data to build your workload model, else you're doomed.
Yeah. And Howard, the more you go, the further back you go, the more you're realizing the majority of our testing in the 90s was back office systems. And yep, the more of we're testing in the 21st century, the modern era, these are consumer-facing public. Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
Jake. So I think the real win is also that we have better cooperation and better data extensibility and collaboration of data between these different departments. So, your data is shareable on an API, so is mine, blah, 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 and we can connect data. And I think that's the elegance of just modern computing architectures. Thank you, Microsoft, for XML, and thank you, Novell, for inventing the Linux kernel that supported that, and blah, 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 yeah.
But even maybe modern computing organizations, because I'm going to tell you, I did a workshop for a client 2 weeks ago, and it just wasn't the QA group and the performance engineering workshop I was doing. I had ops people in there. I had the business people in there. I had the QA people in there. There was another group, and I apologize, I don't remember who they were, but, you know, again, not typical that would be in that type of seminar. Everybody was working on this and thinking about this together right off the bat. And I loved the attitude. And I'm telling you, I'm finding that more and more lately. So it's really a beautiful thing.
So the idea of automatically correlating data from prod to test and from test to prod, if you're not exercising that technique with your existing tools, look at some new tools that can help you do that. And the idea that it makes every test you run more valid, and it makes every understanding from prod more useful. Like, why did we spend $1 million a year on New Relic or on Impulse or on HPE monitoring, right? Why are we even doing RUM? Why are we doing all that?
We spent that because people need to have it on their resume.
Forget the resume. Actually provide value to your company and help a developer make a different decision about code. Help an ops person make a decision about how to configure something. I mean, this is what we can do to make a difference. And, you know, these tools, this idea of correlating this data, no one else is going to figure this out. They're in their silos. As a load tester, you can go back and forth, right? The idea of our talent is we can actually correlate and understand how this data relates to other data. That's a specialty you should be crafting, right? That's the mathematical thing that you're good at that other people may not be good at with their blinders on.
And that kind of separates you from a run-of-the-mill performance tester to more of a performance engineer.
Performance engineer and actually a world-class engineer or even a performance architect. Or if you're really, really good, you will become the chief performance officer of your company.
I want to be there when that first chief performance officer is created, I can cry.
I've been out there harping the sun all over the place lately.
Yep, we just said it here. Guys, we have, to be really honest with you, we've gone through almost an hour and 40 minutes. Do you guys have any summer from what we just chatted about? I mean, this was great to catch up on everything. It's been a while since we recorded. Howard, what are your closing thoughts on kind of everything we talked about?
Look, I think, again, I stated a little earlier, our job today is more complex than it was before. Mm-hmm. So many moving parts. And, you know, we need to think the old ways aren't going to work. So we need to keep working and developing the new techniques as we keep growing. Same thing from a tools perspective, right? Old legacy tools aren't going to work. We need to keep improving our tool sets to expand and grow with what we're doing,
right?
Especially with all the front end pieces too, because on a website, 80-90% of your stuff is front end.
Yeah, because they sucked for so long at fixing their stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah. James, what are your closing thoughts here?
Architecture.
Yes,
as things get more and more complex, you need to have patterns that you can draw from. And as new tools come into play, either on the client side or the backend side or log analysis or actually generating the performance test, you need to have those architectural foundations that allow you to see what are the efficiencies of the tools, mm-hmm. where they can be deployed, what information they're going to get out that actually helps to improve value in your analysis and to the customer. And we see an awful lot of individuals who are being pressed into service who have very, very weak architectural skills. And really, that's doing a disservice to the project and a disservice to the customers. In many cases, it's increasing risk. And having more and more tools is not helping that person be successful.
Yeah. And even though the tools may have marvelous features, you've got people who don't quite know why they might use those features to their benefit. In my review, it's nice to hear both of you give your feedback and ideas here, because it always makes me change my ideas on what I'm seeing and what I'm hearing from people. And most importantly, I think when it comes to adopting a new tool or a new technique, I think don't be afraid of something new is the most important thing here, right? At the same time, for those of you like me who've been around for a very long time using many, many tools, there are some really good things that people overlook in a classic tool like LoadRunner. Even to some extent in Cloud Test, they might be overlooking that to go to the Loader.io or
BlazeMeter. I see a lot of people who overlook the live analysis feature of Sosta Cloud Test,
yeah.
which is a great feature. It's a differentiating feature for that tool,
yeah.
and it works really well.
Well, it's really the hottest thing out there when you're using it. Like I can talk about this for hours, but we're closing it up, so I won't. But James,
but
you're right.
Hot
on
or
that.
Not, we often get a lot of pressure to adopt a new technique or adopt a new tool without fully understanding why or understanding the impact of our actions or our decisions. And, you know, for those of you that are in a situation where you're not given a choice, you're just told you will use new tool X or new tool Y, you can always reach out to us, ask@perfbytes.com, and we'll help you understand why this tool works the way it does, what the shortcomings are, or what the great things are, to the point live analysis you guys just bring up, and what you might be missing. So don't hesitate to call out to us. Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this great episode about Perf Bytes around techniques. If you had no idea that your techniques were lacking and your spouse or partner were making some complaints, now's your chance to have reviewed different techniques on how to make things work better for you and maybe, you know, bolster your relationship. And, of course, thanks for listening to this episode because you might have learned something.
Thanks, everyone. We appreciate you listening to this show tonight. We're all here to wish you a Happy New Year and a Merry Christmas.
And special thanks to Brenda.
Oh, yeah, and to Brenda, who is asleep by now because we've been recording for 3.5 hours.
Awesome. James.
Mom, thanks for tuning in.
Yeah, thanks for staying up late. Who knows? She might be listening to this very late. Don't you think?
Yeah.
No, Mom. No, she goes to bed at 9 o'clock.
9 o'clock. That's probably right. That's very good. I'll say special thanks to the sexy Irish voice of Perf Bytes, who's accompanying me on a few trips here to the UK. She's going to be in out in San Francisco with us in STPCon, and so she's participating in the testing world a little bit more every week. So thanks to her for supporting the Perf Bytes podcast and doing everything she can do for the community.
Hey, Polly, who will we powered by?
Today's show is powered by Mr. Fusion.
Mr. Fusion?
Mr. Fusion.
Wait a minute.
It'll power your DeLorean. It'll power your house. It'll power your personal pleasure.
You don't need batteries.
All of the content of today's Perf Bytes episode is 100% copyrighted and protected by that device James just referred to that was powered by Fusion.
By batteries.
Violate the copyright, and we'll use that device on you.
Batteries? Where we're going, we don't need batteries.
Batteries? We don't need no stinking batteries.
Exactly.
We have Mr. Fusion.
Mr. Fusion. Thank you, James, for that. That's just evil. For more information about Perf Bytes, visit the show's website at www.perfbytes.com or follow us on the Twitter, the Tumblr, the Facebook. And, of course, you can always subscribe and listen to the Perf Bytes podcast on iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn Radio, Stitcher, and testingpodcast.com. Just open your favorite listening app, search for Perf Bytes, and click the subscribe button. And keep in mind that you can send us an email with your questions or thoughts at ask@perfbytes.com or even leave us a voicemail at 77-LOAD-PERF. That's 775-623-7373. And then the Sarge says something like,
keep those cards, letters, iTunes reviews, email, faxes, and notes via a DeLorean powered by Fusion coming our way.
And throw a few grenades at the enemy.
Yeah, that too.
I mean, that's what we hired you for. Perfect Mongo.
We love them. We need them. And by golly, we just gotta have them.
Gentlemen and ladies listening, the Perf Bytes show and staff are supporters of the Practical Performance Analyst, the Performance Engineering Book of Knowledge, Test Bash and the Ministry of Testing, the Computer Measurement Group, the Workshop on Performance and Reliability, and of course, the Software Test Professionals Community of Software Testers.
Thank you for joining us today for today's episode. We will catch you next time on the Perf Bytes show.
Bum, 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 bum. Bum. Good night, everyone.
Bum, 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 bum.
Good night, James. Good night, Mark.